Hey, news fans. It's another full week of Takeaway Podcast starting with today. We'll talk with the president of a historically black university about accepting funding from the Trump administration, and we'll see if we can make sense of the indictment of NFL star and social activist Michael Bennett. Plus, we'll discuss the treatment of women in a medical system not built for them with author Michelle Lent Hirsch and your calls. But we start with a huge series of marches that dominated the weekend with teenagers who were there. It's the Takeaway for Monday, March 26th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, guest hosting this week. Across the nation this weekend, young people marched for change. Here are some of their voices.
Hello, my name is Johnny Benthal. I'm a senior at North Star Academy. I'm currently volunteering at the March for Our Lives. We're getting up and ready. I'm here with my friend
Tiffany Watkins.
And we're excited. It's cold outside, but it's okay because it is for a good cause.
A great cause.
We are really excited and ready to see who's going to come out and support.
Hi, my name is Gina Matos. I'm 18 years old and I attend Eastside High School in Newark, New Jersey. And I'm on my way to March for Our Lives, Newark.
My name is Uma Mariam and I'm 17 years old. I go to Martin Van Buren High School in New York City. And currently we're on our way to the March for Our Lives protest in Washington, D.C.
Hello, this is Ann Bowie. I'm 17 years old, a student from Martin Van Buren High School. The time is now 7:11 a.m. Right now, I'm on the bus with my leadership class. Right now, everyone on the bus seems excited.
The whole purpose of our going to the protest is really standing up with the generation, with our generation, sharing our voices so that they don't feel alone.
We are the future! We are the future!
I'm feeling really empowered right now. I'm really amazed at the turnout that has come. There's a lot of people here, and I'm just amazed by the amount of support that we have right now.
Not today, NRA! Not today, NRA!
Right now, I'm at the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. As I expected, this place is packed. Right now, I'm standing in front of the March for Our Lives stage, and there's a student speaking right now. Listen.
I was crying hearing some people. Because if that were me, if that happened to any of my family member, or my brother, or me alone, or my friends, my best friends here, I wouldn't know what to do. But seeing them gather up courage and coming together gave me hope that my generation can really change history once and for all.
Look at the numbers here in the crowd today. Do you see this?
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
It's Gina Matos. I'm here at March for Our Lives, Newark. There's got to be thousands of people here. There's parents, teachers, students. Like, it's amazing.
No guns in whose hands? No guns in teachers' hands!
No guns in whose hands?
No guns in teachers' hands!
No guns in teachers' hands! No.
Heartbreaking to see those students talk about their experience, and it just makes this march mean a lot more to me. Hearing the speeches from these students, like up close and personal, and you just, it's very heartbreaking. And seeing everyone looking at the people talking, and I can see the looks on everyone's faces, and you can tell that everyone here is just so passionate about this cause.
No more!
No more! Should we have to stand up to this kind of cruelty? No more should we have to be silent. Because if our silence is taken for granted, we shall no longer keep our mouth shut.
I
think I'm very proud of what I did today, and I think like this will help me continue to move and do more outside of school and more like into City Hall. I want to do something for Black Lives Matter. I'm not sure what I want to do, how I want to do it, and when I want to do it, but I want to do it before I go to college, because I'm sure I won't be staying in state. So I want to make a difference here before I leave.
In my day-to-day life, I just hope that I'll think back on this time when I went to DC and I participated in an event that I really believed in. Maybe later down, gun laws might change. Hopefully they will, but even if it doesn't, like, I don't think anyone here will give up.
Very powerful moments captured on tape by young people who want to make a difference. Now, that was this weekend, but on Monday, what are those students feeling about the future? One of those students you heard from was Janae Benthal. She's a senior at North Star Academy High School. It's a charter school in Newark, New Jersey.
It was extremely empowering to see, like, all the different people that came out. Like, it was more than just, like, the people from Newark. It was also the governor there. So it just felt like it was very, like, liberating and powerful.
So why did you go, Janae? What were you trying to gain from this?
Well, I went because I led the walkout at my school first. And so when I found out about it, I was like, okay, this is more widespread. And this is something that I can do, like, more like, yeah, it's like more widespread, and it's something that I can do like outside that's bigger, like, because it has something to do with City Hall. And so, like, I chose to, like, be involved with it.
What happens next for you? What do you do to keep this momentum going?
I think, well, right now it's more about raising awareness about gun control and to keep pushing about it. So, like, even though, like, I won't be doing, like, anything big like I did Saturday, I still want to, like, you know, be on social media and letting people know that these things do exist, or keeping them updated on things like the gun control votes that are happening in Congress soon.
So that's how you plan to stay involved, by keeping people aware of what's going on and to pressure lawmakers?
Yes.
So if you don't see change soon, are you worried that you might sort of give up? What are your friends saying?
I don't think it will cause me to give up, considering the fact that it's something that needs to be said. So, like, the more you're quiet about it, the less things happen. And so people around me have said, like, they wish that we can do things more widespread and things bigger than just the walkout, because the walkout didn't have anything to do with, like, government officials. So I think, like, taking it to, like, the government and City Hall is important.
So you were leader. You led that first sort of walkout from your school. You went to this weekend's. But what do you say to some of the other people who may not be as bold or confident as you? How do you keep them in the movement?
You can keep them, like, in the, like, not in the background, like, the people who handle, like, the mechanical things. Like, on Saturday, we had people in the back who were just, like, in charge of, like, stage managers, or making sure that no one was in the back that didn't have to be in the back. So, like, small things like that can make them feel like they're making a difference, even though, like, they're not saying much.
So when we look at Newark, you know, Newark has had sort of a high murder rate, even though it's dropping over the years. Newark is nationally known for its gun violence, and actually saw an increase in non-fatal shootings in 2017. Does that affect the way you see these demonstrations?
I think it does, because I feel like a lot of people don't talk about gun control until it happens in places, in schools, in Florida, so, like, predominantly white spaces. So I think, like, it's something that is common here. So I feel like gun control is a constant conversation that we have here in Newark.
So you say that when it happens in predominantly white spaces, it's different than when it happens in places like Newark?
Yes. Like, there isn't much of discussion of gun control when Black students are getting shot every day here, like, outside of homes and things like that. But it becomes a topic of conversation when people in Florida get shot and killed. So I think, like, that's why a lot of people in Newark were against protesting, because it's like, well, what about us when we're in trouble, and what about us when things happen to us? So I think like it's important to make known the intersectionality between what happened in Florida and also what's happening in places of colors like Newark.
What about wealth? Did you notice a difference once you were with a larger group?
I did realize the difference, because everything that we did, we had to do amongst each other. So like any food that we had for like the volunteers, people donated those. Water, people donated those. Like everything that we had was pretty much donated. Like we didn't get like, you know, a lot of like government funding, but like everything we did was like very community based. And so I think that was also good for us as well.
So I want to make sure that we're clear. What changes do you want to see in gun laws in the United States or locally in New Jersey?
Well, for me, I know like big things aren't going to happen fast. So it's just the little things like getting rid of like ignorant comments, like teachers should hold guns and things like that. Well, like make me like hope to see a difference. Like I just want to see a small difference in the way that government officials talk about the way gun control affects communities. And I hope that people of color communities such as Newark are going to be more included in the topic of conversation rather than just other wealthy superior groups. So I just want minority groups to be a part of the conversation.
And I heard you say on Saturday you are interested in getting involved in Black Lives Matter. How do you think the Black Lives Matter movement is linked to this movement, if at all?
Okay, because Black lives are always being killed off. Black lives are always being shot and killed by each other, by cops, by other people. So it's like those two are at the intersections, because Black lives do matter the same way we say that the way that people who are affected by gun control lives matter. So I feel like we're always being killed by our guns, and our lives are always being taken by guns. So this is how we can help stop these things. Like I said, these two things are at the intersection of one another.
Thank you so much, Janae Benthal, senior at North Star Academy High School. Thank you.
No problem.
So much pride, pain, and passion this weekend. We also heard from adults out there who attended marches across the country.
I'm Arvind, calling from Renton, Washington. I marched because I'd like to see some change. I do not want to hear any more shooting deaths, no more children dying in schools, or people dying in concerts or clubs. I hope to see assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, bump stocks out of people's hands. We need to pay more attention to mental health. Guns give power over another life. People using guns should be held accountable for their decisions.
This is Gwendolyn Walski. I was at the Chicago March, and it was outstanding. There's people as far as I could see. I would like to start with getting rid of assault and automatic weapons, as well as high-capacity magazines.
This is Marilyn from Venice, Florida. I hope it encourages young people everywhere to vote. Hope it starts a movement to lower the voting age to 16. So very, very many, many hopes.
What do you think about the March for Our Lives protest over the weekends? Did you attend one? Let us know. You can tweet us at The Takeaway or join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page. Hundreds of thousands of people around America have been gathering, marching, and demanding federal lawmakers take steps to curb gun violence. With so much pressure on them, lawmakers slipped three provisions related to guns into the $1.3 trillion federal spending bill that just passed on Friday. Now, it's important to note, they did this before this weekend's massive protests in Newark, Washington, and in hundreds of other cities around the country. Here's Senator John Cornyn of Texas on the Senate floor on Thursday.
Madam President, our constituents are frustrated, frightened, and fed up. They want us to do something. More importantly than that, they want us to do something that will be effective and save lives. And I'm happy to say the Fix NICS bill fits that description. Students are worried, understandably, and parents of students are worried. They simply don't want what happened at Parkland to occur to them.
He's talking about the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System. It's called NICS for short. The Fix Nicks Act was one of those provisions addressing gun violence that was included in the federal spending bill. Some critics say the provisions don't do enough. Amanda Becker is here to help us break it all down. She covers Congress and the White House for Reuters. Amanda, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So which provisions in the federal spending bill deal with gun violence and gun research?
So as you said, there were three provisions in the spending bill that deal with guns. You were just talking about the Fix Nicks portion of it. That was a bipartisan measure that essentially tries to strengthen an already existing background check system operated by the FBI by giving states some money to encourage them to kind of be faster about sending their information into that database. There was a second one that gives about $50 million in grants to schools to prepare to deal with the threat of gun violence in terms of taking additional security measures and that sort of thing. And then there was a third provision that clarifies that an amendment passed in 1996 does not prohibit the Centers for Disease Control from studying the causes of gun violence.
So which was the most significant, given the fact that there were three? And they seem related, but very different.
I think if you're speaking to people and groups who would like to see more gun control measures taken, they would say that they're all pretty minor. $50 million spread out over 50 states and all the schools in those states is not a huge chunk of money in a $1.3 trillion spending bill. The Fix Nicks portion of it, it doesn't expand background checks. It doesn't create universal background checks. It's simply trying to just make the system that already exists work a little bit better. In terms of the language, I think that perhaps that could end up having a bigger impact. You immediately saw even the language they put in said, the CDC has always been able to do this, but we'll just, you know, write in here that, again, that they're allowed. And what happened in 1996, this amendment was passed called the Dickey Amendment. It said that the Centers for Disease Control and other federal agencies couldn't use funds appropriated by Congress to promote gun control. How that's been interpreted over the years, though, is that the Centers for Disease Control has not done much research, if any, on the causes of gun violence because it was interpreted as a quote-unquote ban and they were afraid about losing their funding. So it did have a chilling effect over the years. And you even saw the NRA tweeting last week and over the weekend, the CDC has always been able to do this. This doesn't change anything. So maybe that chilling effect will lessen or lift after this, and you might see some research into the causes of gun violence at the CDC.
So to put that into perspective, what does it mean to have more research into gun violence? What will this increased knowledge do for lawmakers? How does it affect policy?
So right now, there's just not the data about the causes. So this would allow the CDC to treat this as a public health matter, like you would a flu outbreak or something like that. Study it, look into common characteristics of perhaps some of the people who are involved in these violent situations, and just really kind of keep track of everything in order to use that data to develop better policy.
So President Trump has said a lot about, quote, arming schools. Is that what the money for security is for?
No, and that's an important thing to note. That $50 million is not for arming teachers or arming, you know, assistant teachers or anyone in schools. It's to help them prepare by taking additional security measures, but not arming teachers.
So were you surprised that these provisions were included at all?
Well, I guess it goes both ways because I've seen other shootings and I've seen nothing happen after those other shootings. So I think that we have maybe reached a tipping point where they felt like they had to do something and this is the result of that. It remains to be seen whether more will be done.
There were other issues that were considered as well. Did anything not make it in that you think is important for us to know about?
There are a lot of different suggested pieces of legislation in Congress related to guns. You know, there's one to bring the assault weapons ban back. There is one to create universal background checks. Those obviously are more contentious pieces of legislation in terms of getting both parties to sign on to them. They obviously were not a part of the spending bill. And the important thing to note is this spending bill was essentially the last chance to pass controversial measures before the midterm elections. And so the idea with a spending bill is you have to fund the government. And so it's something that people kind of have to vote for. And so if you want to get something through Congress, you attach it to that, you know, and that's why it ends up being this massive piece of legislation. So this is the last must-pass bill in this Congress before they all run for re-election. So it was kind of viewed as the last chance to get a lot of things done before these people are having to go back to their districts and ask for people's votes.
That's the key measure, asking for those votes. Thank you so much, Amanda Becker, Reuters correspondent covering Congress and the White House.
Thank you.
NFL player Michael Bennett was indicted in Harris County, Texas, for an alleged incident that took place at the Super Bowl more than a year ago when it was played at NRG Stadium in Houston, Texas. Bennett is charged with felony assault against a 66-year-old paraplegic woman. Authorities claim he shoved the woman while heading to the field to celebrate after the game. This story has a lot of layers. Keep these two points in mind. One, Bennett is known for his social activism and sitting down during the national anthem. Two, he recently signed a multi-million dollar contract to play with the Philadelphia Eagles. To help us connect some of these dots, welcome Chuck Modiano. He's sports columnist for the New York Daily News. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So walk us through what happened at the Super Bowl that led to Bennett's indictment.
Well, you know, according to police, his brother, you know, had just won the Super Bowl, Martellus Bennett, with the New England Patriots, and he was running onto the field. And on his way to run onto the field, according to police, he had defied a police order not to go onto the field and shoved a 66-year-old woman, and who 14 months later, the report is that she sprained her shoulder. And we find out 14 months later, there's a felony for this to shove, which is very problematic. The 14 months later is very problematic. And the press conference by the police officer was very problematic, where he used words like, Bennett is morally corrupt, morally bankrupt, pretty pathetic. This doesn't sound like a police chief who has a objective lens going forward. So given the background that you mentioned of Michael Bennett's activism and Michael Bennett calls for police accountability and Michael Bennett standing with Colin Kaepernick, this is problematic all around. We don't see these types of charges for shoves. And if you were to charge people for shoves running onto the field, we'd have a lot of people with felony charges.
So this is a felony. Normally, cases like this, wouldn't it be handled in civil court? Why make this a felony?
Well, I think that's right. Normally, a case like this is handled in civil court. Normally, a case like this is settled out of court. There's nothing about this case factually that is consistent with the charge of being shoved, what we see with other cases. But it is consistent with a bit of a backlash that we've seen against some athletes, particularly black athletes.
So you're just above hinting at it. So do you believe that this is a form of retaliation for his activism on and off the field?
Well, I do believe it is a form of his retaliation. And I say that, you know, there's some people who said, well, wait for all the facts. Well, we know we're not going to see any more videos. So the facts are these statements that we have. The facts are the felony charge for a shove. And we have to use them and compare them to other cases that we've seen or have not seen. So, you know, when we look at those who stood with Kaepernick, we're seeing a lot of levels of retaliation, whether it is from the NFL. Eric Reed currently is not being signed. We know Colin Kaepernick is being blackballed. There are a number of other players that we find aren't being signed. And now the largest extension of that is a police charge against Bennett. And when you look at the Michael Bennett and you listen to the press conference, what we find is there was anger that he defied a police order. So I think that's what really we're talking about. We're going to get you back. And I know to someone who doesn't know all the facts, that may sound like a jump to conclusion, but in absence of any similar charges, particularly to white athletes, this is the most logical conclusion we can come up with.
There's a lot at stake. Thank you so much, Chuck Modiano, sports columnist for the Daily News.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier this month, The Takeaway introduced you to a woman trying to navigate the healthcare system. Writer Abby Norman suffered from crippling abdominal pain and documented her story of diagnosis and treatment in a book called Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. So many of you connected with her. We got numerous messages from listeners who experienced challenges similar to Norman's, asking us to explore this topic deeper. Your messages prompted our series of conversations this week, exploring the biases women face in the medical system. We're calling the series Taking Pains with Women's Health. Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti joined me to introduce the series, which began with Abby Norman's story.
So she was 19 in college, training as a dancer. She was gripped by this horrible pain in her abdominal area, and it really changed her life. She ended up going on something of a quest to get relief and help, and what she encountered along the way actually really surprised her.
After all of these months of saying, there's something very wrong in my body, and then doctors saying, there's nothing wrong, you're stressed out, there's nothing wrong, maybe you pulled a muscle. I could not have really known at the time that that was going to be the rhetoric that would chase me throughout this entire experience.
So that rhetoric that she's talking about is not being believed, feeling dismissed when she went to a doctor with excruciating pain. So this book was all about what she faced trying to get the medical community to believe her and to give her the treatment she needed and the experiences of similar women as well.
It's so difficult to hear because I keep on thinking about the women in my life, my colleagues, my family members who may have also experienced this. But what about you? What drew you to Abby's book?
I also trained for many years as a dancer, and the idea of losing your strength and watching your body waste away and feeling helpless, like no one knew how to help you and no one was listening to you, that really resonated with me. As did the idea that she brings up in this book that so many women go into a doctor's office, express pain, and feel dismissed and don't get answers, especially when it's something that has to do with reproduction or menstruation, things that many doctors still say, you know what? That's normal. Pain is normal. Deal with it.
And they often dismiss it as sort of a psychological or mental issue rather than what it is, a very real physical issue.
Yeah, you know, and she ultimately did get a diagnosis of endometriosis, which is actually pretty common. It's incredibly painful. The numbers that experts give are around 10% of women, but that's probably pretty low considering how underdiagnosed it actually is.
You know, you mentioned that, you know, especially with these issues as seen through the lens of reproduction and menstruation, what does Abby attribute to this?
So, of course, that's a huge piece of what she's trying to get at, right? And it's complicated. And it's a question that we're going to try to answer over the next few days of coverage that we do here on the show about what women face in the healthcare system. But part of this, of course, has to do with history and a very long history of women facing doctors and a medical community that isn't willing to accept issues that have to do with menstruation and reproduction as being worthy of more research, as being worthy of more funding, more testing. That needs to change. And Abby underscores that. Abby also says that one of the things she really wants to see is doctors recognizing their own unconscious biases to the extent that they can. But sometimes the knowledge is not there when it comes to things like endometriosis, like we mentioned, and maybe like chronic fatigue syndrome.
It's so difficult to believe that there is this huge lack of understanding over women's bodies, mostly because if you look at the plain demographics on Earth, women are a slight majority of the population. So the fact that we don't understand enough about their biology and how they're responding to medicines is really deeply troubling. What else are we going to hear in this series?
One of the things we'll look at is the gap in access and care that women of color in particular face in this country. It's something that's been reported but still bears a lot of exploring. Women of color are more likely to die of breast cancer, of heart disease. These gaps are really large. So we're going to talk about why and possible solutions there. We'll also hear a focus on young women, because something we don't think about a lot is what young women face when they're out in the world with major health issues. And we'll also talk, as I mentioned before, about the lack of research and funding in certain areas and how we can actually move ahead.
So, Alex, we're going to be hearing more about young women coming up, right?
That's right. You'll hear my conversation with author Michelle Lent Hirsch. She's a science writer, and her new book is called Invisible: How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationships, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine.
Thank you so much. Really looking forward to this.
Thanks so much, Duarte.
Meet Michelle Lent Hirsch.
I am in pain. often, and I have to take a lot of medicine to stay alive and have to go to a lot of screenings and.
In 2010, Michelle had hip surgery. She was only 25 years old and fresh-faced. So when she tried to take an open disabled seat on a public bus in New York, people yelled at her. And they kept yelling even when she explained she'd just had hip surgery.
It's almost like people cannot reconcile a young woman's face with facts that that young woman is telling them. You know, I had surgery, or I have MS, I need this seat, I use a cane. Impossible to reconcile for a lot of people.
Michelle Lent Hirsch has a new book out called Invisible: How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationships, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine. She talked with Alexandra Boti about how her situation is more common than many people think. Young women sometimes have serious health problems like autoimmune disorders and cancer, which she faced. So Hirsch interviewed dozens of women to show people what it's like to be sick in a world that doesn't want to see you that way.
It seemed to me when I started to have health issues that there was this knowledge that I had in me from pop culture or from stories I'd heard that women who are sick are going to be left. And when I started to talk to people about it, unfortunately, I did hear some stories that confirmed that that does happen. And I also did some research and found some statistics that were quite staggering. For instance, one study found that in heterosexual married couples, so a man and a woman married to each other, where either the husband or the wife had a brain tumor, if the husband had a brain tumor, it didn't really necessarily show any change in what would happen in the marriage compared to like the average couple in America. And if the woman had a brain tumor, then the men were 10 times more likely to leave. That is not only, you know, upsetting to hear those statistics, but it's really upsetting when you're interviewing someone and it's happened to them.
You also write, and it's in the subtitle of your book, about pressures on young women to seem fine, to seem okay, to essentially accommodate people in their lives, to make them feel comfortable with their own illness.
Right. That was the other major thread that I found across all kinds of women who'd had all kinds of health issues, is the idea that we all felt we had to seem great, fine, chipper, no matter what was happening. There's a common phrase that, you know, people who've studied gender or just talk about feminist issues use, that women are taught to take up less space. But when you have a health issue, you necessarily sometimes have to take up a little more space if it's just going to the doctor a little extra or needing a little help, maybe getting out of a cab because you just had some surgery. And sometimes the most minor things feel like they might be a burden to someone else because we've been taught to not burden other people. There's this stereotype of women as the caretaker. So, oh no, if the caretaker's sick, what's going to happen, right? And, you know, my advice to people is just have empathy for the person who's saying, hey, my hip actually hurts too much to keep walking. I know we're having a great time, but do you mind if we hop on the bus for a minute? These things, again, are so minor, but I think that when we all are operating with this idea that young women don't get sick, then it's so hard for people to deal with it. They kind of freeze up.
One of the things that strikes me, too, is that if you are unwell, quickly the focus becomes, well, what does this mean for your ability to have children? And you write about in the book, that may not be the first question that women have or the first concern that young women have. It may just be, I want my pain to stop.
Right. There's a researcher who I interviewed who's at Hunter here in the CUNY system in New York. And she told me the story of a young woman who was diagnosed with leukemia. And leukemia, you have to treat very quickly. And there is not always time to deal with, well, what are we going to do if the woman, you know, has a uterus, has eggs, what are we going to do? How are we going to save her eggs? There may not be any time. You just have to save her life. But what happened is this young woman went into the doctor with her husband, her own parents, and her husband's parents. And the two sets of parents just kept telling the doctor, save her eggs, save her fertility, we want grandkids. And she's sitting there. This is the message that she's getting, is not that these people care that I live to see next week. They haven't even asked her if she wants kids, right? So I think you're absolutely right that often the focus is on this thing that many people don't even want to begin with, and that really sort of makes the woman feel like, you know, your humanity and your experience and your pain and whether or not you're going to be okay, we think that's secondary to whether or not you can pump out a baby. And that's really a problem when it starts to influence the way doctors treat people as well.
I want to turn to concerns about the workplace and what young women face when they are building careers. Often women in their 20s and 30s are building careers. It's the beginning of a lifetime of working. And you actually talk about a woman in the book who sort of likens having a very serious medical issue as a young woman in the office to kind of almost another glass ceiling, a whole other layer to get through.
Yeah, so there's a woman I interviewed for the book named Brenda, and she has a neurological issue that has finally since been diagnosed, but actually when I interviewed her, we didn't yet know what it was. We just knew that it was affecting her increasingly as the days went on. And she has a very high-profile job in D.C. And Brenda, who identifies as a young woman who's Latina, Jewish, and disabled, said, I'm a woman, and there's the glass ceiling because of that. But then on top of that, because I'm Latina, there's a wall now for me too that I have to get around or get through. And she said, and now that I'm disabled, it's as if there's an obstacle course on top of that. And because her neurological issue was affecting her speech, she said, it's as if now I have to sing an opera as well, even though I have a speech impediment. And she is incredibly successful. I mean, she is a young woman who, at a very young age, was the press secretary for the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. This is someone who has worked extremely hard at a very young age. And she is still up against people not taking her seriously because suddenly maybe she has to use a cane or maybe her speech is not quite as clear.
Do you think that making these stories more visible, do you think that will make change here? What are you actually hoping concretely will happen?
Yeah, one thing that I really hope will happen is that we stop having this idea that a young person cannot be sick. You know, if you're sick, it's hard enough to have to try to pretend you're not sick. I know from experience, your job gets instantly harder. Your relationships instantly don't feel quite as real if you can't open up to people. And so I hope that a lot of people read this book who are not sick, because I think that we're missing empathy in a lot of these situations, just fundamental empathy. We're looking at people and saying, I read your face as young and feminine. I therefore don't believe you. And that's affecting people in all kinds of ways.
Michelle Lent Hirsch, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michelle Lent Hirsch is a writer and editor. She's author of the new book, Invisible, How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationships, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine.
That was Takeaway producer Alexandra Botti there. You can find all parts of this series about women and health at thetakeaway.org/womenspain.
Dr. Jackson, Board of Trustees, thank you so very, very much for this great honor and privilege. I am honored to become a Wildcat. And it's a real honor and privilege to be with you as we celebrate the Bethune-Cookman University Class of 2017.
That was U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos being booed at the historically black college Bethune-Cookman University in Florida last May. Students turned their backs in protest at the commencement ceremony. It's no secret, black voters overwhelmingly went against President Donald Trump. He earned only 8% of the black vote, and a string of racially charged conversations and controversies, including the president calling white supremacist protesters, quote, good people, inflamed tensions between the administration and black communities. Still, on Friday, President Trump signed a bill boosting funds for historically black colleges by 14%. I want to repeat that. President Donald Trump is giving more money to historically black colleges. It's the latest in a growing list of investments in America's historically black colleges coming from the White House. So, right now, black colleges are engaged in an extremely delicate dance as they work with an administration that's wildly unpopular with students and alumni. Hubert L. Grimes is the interim president of Bethune-Cookman University. He's here to talk with us about that delicate dance. Hello, President.
Greetings, and how are you today?
I'm doing well. Now, you were the university's lawyer at the time of that commencement. From your perspective, what happened that day? Were you surprised by the student and alumni response?
Well, there had been a lot of preliminary conversations that took place. And of course, there was a lot of media attention that was given leading up to the event. I will tell you that from the university's perspective, recognizing the high ranking office of the secretary is something that is not just important, but something that's very traditional at our university, dating back to the days of our founder, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, who worked for four different presidents with both parties, dating back to, we call it the Truman days, Roosevelt, prior to that, Coolidge, and even as far back as Hoover. So we're not averse to the opportunity to be able to work with the offices of high-ranking government officials. But I will say that from the point of view of our students, that we didn't do as well of a job in getting with our students beforehand to explain to them the significance of having the Office of the Secretary of Education.
So in February 2017, President Trump signed an HBCU executive order. This is what he had to say during this signing. Listen to this.
This month has been a wonderful opportunity to celebrate African American history and to begin working together to create a better future for African Americans and universities and colleges and everything that is African American. Today we're taking action to help make that future happen and that future better.
HBCU advocates predicted President Trump would be bad for historically black colleges, but the administration seems to be building quite a list of investments in historically black colleges. How much has the president done for black colleges and universities in America?
Well, his signing of the omnibus bipartisan bill last week, including our funding for the rest of the year, resulted in a 14% increase in funding for HBCUs, not to mention the additional help that's going to be needed for many of the students that attend our HBCUs. That in itself is a major milestone in the not only the stabilizing many of our HBCUs, but also stabilizing the funding sources for our students. And so from that perspective, it was a broad-based effort that existed both on the House side as well as on the Senate side, and then ultimately going to the president for his signature.
So given the really concrete successes that HBCUs have had, how do you communicate that with your alumni and students who have really strong opinions about Trump and the administrations? How do you tell them that sometimes you have to work with the president's team in good faith, regardless of party and politics?
Well, I think you've just said it all. We have to continue to put that message out. Because truth be told, the importance of federal government support for our institutions is indeed necessary. And it's always been necessary. So for us to be able to get the kind of funding that's going to help us with our infrastructure, that's going to help us with being able to fund many new programs that ultimately will lead to those students of this generation being able to successfully pursue their careers is definitely necessary. And so that's part of that discussion. That's part of that dialogue. And while we must always be able to work across the aisles and to develop partnerships with whether it be both parties or whether it be between government and the private sector, whatever's necessary for our university to survive, the real thrust and the real goal long term is that we will create strong, capable citizens who are able to take care of themselves. Many of our students are first generation college educated. Many of our students otherwise would not be able to attend or complete college were it not for the help and the assistance of governmental sources. And so from that perspective, we do have to look at what is the big picture. The big picture is to help our students to be able to successfully navigate the waters of education and to be successful contributing citizens of this great country.
Focusing on the big picture, does it matter what the president says if he continues to support HBCUs in concrete ways?
Well, I think that, again, there are many of us that get shocked and upset at the comments of our president. I mean, that's not unusual. It's across the board throughout the country. But at the same time, when we're focused upon the work that has to be done for our universities and for our students, you know, we still got to continue to push forward. It matters not who's sitting in the White House, but it matters who's able to help us to be able to accomplish the dreams of our students, again, of our founders. And again, I look back and bring you back around to, for example, in Bethune-Cookman's situation, we think back and look at the various challenges that existed back almost 100 years ago. I look back at the eras of the Great Depression. Our founder learned how to work with Hoover, Coolidge, and became an advisor for Roosevelt, and then ultimately for Truman. And all of these were different people with different vantage points, different political persuasions. At the end of the day, we were able to survive. And that's the same thing that exists here in 21st century America. And thank God for the collective efforts of groups like the United Negro College Fund and other groups who have led the way for us to work together. One of the things our founder did, she co-founded United Negro College Fund back in 1935 with Dr. Frederick Patterson of Tuskegee. And that was a big to-do then. And even now, those partnerships will be the thing that will help us to continue forward.
Hubert L. Grimes, interim president of Bethune-Cookman University. Thanks for chatting with us.
Thank you.
So you heard the start of our series, Taking Pains with Women's Health, earlier this hour. And now we're hearing from you. Many of you told us about bias you felt from doctors.
Hi, my name is Sandy. I'm calling from New Jersey. Yes, I am a woman, and I have to say, I felt bias from both male and female doctors. Over the course of almost 2 years, I could not be diagnosed with the cause of a progressive skin issue. I saw 5 different dermatologists in that time, each one eventually telling me it's emotional or stress, or I'm bringing it on myself. Finally, I was diagnosed and can now manage it, and no, it was never my emotions or stress.
So difficult to hear sometimes. Do you have a story to share about bias in the medical system or what it's like being a woman in pain? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Giraldino, filling in this week, and this is The Takeaway.
Change can be uncomfortable.
Change is necessary. We need to talk.
We need to act.
We matter.
We must unite.
What does it take to create change? In Sacramento, a community responding to the killing of Stephon Clark is drawing support from around the country.
Say his name.
Stephon Clark.
Stephon Clark.
That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.